Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
I couldn't be better.
Good.
And I'm here today to listen to what story. I have no idea. I'm coming in blind today.
You are kind of coming in blind. It is going to be about a civil engineering disaster.
Ooh. Okay. Well,
let me explain the reaction.
Okay. Bad that people are in danger. Probably
right.
That people will die if a civil engineer is involved. Something's going down.
Something definitely went down.
However, I'm an engineer.
I
appreciate
understand.
Numbers and things.
I know your excitement was not about the potential of people dying. It was
Let me be clear about that, though.
Yeah, yeah. Be very clear about that. But yeah, it is kind of in your world. It's not computer. They're building a dam.
Well, dam.
Right.
Is it the Hoover Dam?
It's not, but I do mention the Hoover Dam. It's in Los Angeles. It's one of the biggest dam disasters, or I guess just disasters, in Los Angeles history. And it's crazy because most people don't know about it. I guess it did happen like about 100 years ago. Well, okay. Yeah, I got to finish my sentence. It did happen about 100 years ago at this point. But yeah, still, it was a massive event that most people just don't even know about.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I don't really know how far back the disasters you should know about really go. I mean,
well, we were just talking about the plague. So.
I know, right? That was I was going to bring up. It was a little while ago.
Yeah, definitely a lot longer back than this story. This story took place in 1928.
Yeah. No, like dam failures, tsunamis, not for me. When I first moved to Seattle, I literally could not sleep through a night without having like a tsunami nightmare for a few weeks. Because I was like, right, I was maybe 8 blocks off the Sound.
Yeah.
So you could see it out of my window. And I was like, Like, I know that it's inland, but is it possible?
Yeah.
And I just, like, would not know.
And that's on anxiety.
Yeah.
I have to say, of all of the disasters to be a part of, a tsunami or, like, what I'm about to talk about is probably one of the scariest things that a person could experience, in my opinion, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, like, a wall of water coming at you in, like, seconds and there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
Yeah, just a true situation of powerlessness.
Yeah. Anyway, why don't we get started with our story? Because I have a lot to tell you about. And then we can discuss as we go. Sounds good?
Sure.
Great.
That is the show.
That is what we do here. So let's keep doing it. On March 12th, 1928, 2.5 minutes before midnight, the lights in Los Angeles flickered. William Mulholland was asleep in his home near Windsor Square, and he didn't notice. In a canyon 40 miles northwest of the city, a man named Ace Hopewell pulled his motorcycle to the side of the road after passing the St. Francis Dam about a mile back, which was William Mulholland's most recent creation, a wall of concrete 20 stories high holding back 12 billion gallons of water. As he lit a cigarette, he heard the sound of cracking and crumbling. He didn't know it then, but he would be the last living person to see the dam before it ruptured and spewed 12 billion gallons of water. The water would travel 54 miles to the ocean with as many as 10,000 people downstream from the dam. They could feel the vibration and hear the water coming, but to them it just felt like an earthquake, so most people wouldn't even know what hit them. It is considered to have been one of the worst American civil engineering disasters in American history, and the third greatest loss of life in California history, all in an effort to bring water to the American West. But let's rewind a little bit. By the beginning of the 20th century, it had become abundantly clear that the city of Los Angeles needed water. After the Mexican-American War, Los Angeles in the 1850s and 60s was a violent, isolated town, but that reputation would not last, because by the time the Transcontinental Railroad rolled into town in 1876, it was a sunny destination for settlers. All it needed was some water. The men who made Los Angeles refused to slow the population boom that LA was undergoing, and if they wanted this new city to survive, then they needed to have water to have people there. So this disaster did spur from hope. On a beautiful November morning in 1913, 40,000 Angelenos gathered at a new landmark called the Cascades to inaugurate one of the wonders of the modern world. The Los Angeles Aqueduct was a perfect emblem for the city of tomorrow, more than 200 miles of pipes and canals carrying enough water for 2.5 million people, which was 10 times the current population, from the Sierra Nevada mountains to the outskirts of the city. The aqueduct was the start of a new beginning for Los Angeles. It followed the idea of manifest destiny, but it wasn't just about controlling the land, it was about controlling the resources to make the American West the kind of civilization they wanted it to be. The Los Angeles Times wrote, quote, "A mighty river has been brought out of the mountain wilderness, an inexhaustible supply of water." And that was huge for many reasons, one of which was they realized they could use the water to turn generators and generate 90% of the electricity that was needed for Los Angeles, and still have plenty of clean water to do whatever they wanted with. LA could lead the way to a better future, far from the crowded cities in the east. The LA Times also said, "No black pillars of smoke shall blind the sun. No army of grimy workers shall feed the red-mouthed furnaces. For the river, bound with hoops of steel, shall generate the power for numberless industries." So people were excited about the water coming to LA.
This sounds dope. I mean, could you imagine being at that time? It's the roaring 20s, and this is kind of the place to be.
And you just
kind of get to make it your own.
So much water.
Yes, so much water. I got news for you. Inexhaustible for, I don't know what, 80 years?
Right. Yeah, it's definitely going to be
90 years.
A lot sooner than they expected. But they were just painting the American dream. They were trying to make LA as enticing as possible because they wanted as much people there as they could get.
Makes sense.
The mastermind behind the aqueduct was the head of Los Angeles Bureau of Water Works and Supply, which was a man named William Mulholland. Are you familiar with Mulholland Drive in California?
I have heard it.
Yeah, you've probably driven Mulholland Drive. It's like up in the hills. But anyway, it's named after William Mulholland.
Is he's the one who fucked up?
He's the one who fucked up.
I feel like that might warrant a revoking of the street.
Potentially.
Yeah.
But I don't know that they named it before or after everything. I don't know,
he's
actually.
Kind of grandfathered in.
Yeah, I have no idea. So anyway, he was an Irish immigrant who never finished grade school. He started out as a ditch digger, which was the very bottom of the heap. You couldn't start lower than that. And that's why people loved him, because he understood the working man and how to marshal their efforts. He was a working class immigrant who had made good. He was the hardy Irishman, the man of the people, the embodiment of the American dream. So people really trusted him. He was a self-taught engineer, which I thought was very telling wording. And he was nicknamed the Chief, and he quickly impressed his bosses and moved up to superintendent by the age of 31. His goal was to find a water source that would give LA and the San Fernando Valley more water than they could ask for. So he led his search with his friend and former mentor and former LA mayor, Fred Eaton. And that's when they turned their attention to the Owens Valley, which was 224 miles away. So although people of LA thought Mulholland was amazing, the settlers of the Owens River Valley, the source of the water that would be brought to LA, saw William Mulholland very differently. As far as they were concerned, he was taking their river water and leaving their farms and towns to wither away. They had been kept in the dark about the aqueduct, as Mulholland and Eaton quietly bought up their land and their water rights. Eaton had basically gone to their town under the guise of being a fellow rancher and began buying up the land and water rights for far less than they were actually worth, because the people had no idea how valuable their land actually was. And so they just were quietly acquiring all of this land and water and just shipping it to LA. And they were basically like, well, we don't give a shit about you, Owens Valley. Sorry.
Wow. Why were they selling it for way less than it was worth?
They just didn't know what it was worth.
Interesting. Is it just going to run their river dry?
Like, basically, they're sending all of the water to LA.
Damn.
Yeah. So the Owens Valley was a rural, high desert community that had begun to be settled by Euro-Americans in the 1860s, and their fortunes were tied to the Owens River. So the water wasn't exactly stolen, but it was acquired in a very shady way. They certainly didn't tell them that they were sending their water to Los Angeles, But for most Angelenos, any qualms about the project were overshadowed by its breathtaking scale and ambition. It was a massive undertaking, placing metal aqueduct structures in and around valleys, sheer mountains, and long, flat, dry expanses of the California landscape. The thought that you could bring that much water over 200 miles was extraordinary at the time, and even today it would be a huge project. So on one November day in 1913, when Angelenos gathered at the Cascades to celebrate the opening of the aqueduct, they were captivated by the city's promising future. Shortly after 1 p.m., Owens River water was released down the Cascades for the first time, and people were excited. Some people had brought tin cups, and they raced toward the water to get the first sip of this man-made river. As the crowd gathered around the water, Mulholland shouted from a stage, "Only water was needed to make of this region a tremendously rich and productive empire, and now we have it. There it is. Take it." Isn't that just so, like, over the top and grand? It really sounds like it's from a movie.
Yeah, no, it kind of feels like he's Moses or something.
Yeah, you know? He did have lots of power.
Sounds like it. I mean, he's buddy-buddy with the former mayor.
Yeah, and he's, like, responsible for kind of, like, starting L.A. into this, like, major metropolis, creating the L.A. dream of, like, paradise. So the aqueduct was a game changer. It made LA the fastest growing city in the US. It also showed that LA could do bold and amazing things. Suburbs popped up and migrants were pouring into LA. It was a moment of great excitement. But that being said, it wasn't a perfect place by any means. There was still a lot of racial segregation in law and in practice, and violence toward non-white people. So it wasn't a paradise for everybody, but the dream was there. It called to people to come there and start new. And as Los Angeles boomed, Southern California was drying up. As the population blew past the 1 million mark in the early 1920s, the aqueduct flow had been cut almost in half by years of drought. Because, you know, it's a desert, and that's what happens there. They had anticipated that amount of water would last them 50 years, but they would be out of water in only 10. So they had vastly overestimated.
Oh, so it wouldn't even last 10 years?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was going to come up to modern day.
No.
No way?
No way. Mulholland had created the illusion of abundance, so the people of LA kept using more water instead of responding to these drought conditions. There were lawns everywhere, spectacular flower gardens, fountains. The amount of water poured into these lawns was astounding. I mean, they were in a major drought, and
they just weren't acting like
Yeah, they didn't care at all. Because, I mean, they had said, like, this water's going to last us forever. It's going to make this city the best place in the world. And so you can have your luscious green lawn and your crazy flower gardens.
Yeah, and then we never checked on the pipes.
Right. In an attempt to quench the growing thirst of LA, the Bureau of Water went on another buying spree of almost all of the remaining water in the Owens Valley, further undermining the region's economy. And understandably, there was a tremendous amount of anger growing in the Owens Valley. There was a real sense that their community was being destroyed, while this far-off city was turning into a glamorous metropolis by using their water and their resources. There was a lot of resentment that was driven by the decisions and attitudes of people like Mulholland. The farmers in the Owens River Valley weren't perceived as equal citizens. The anger only grew when it became clear that much of the Owens River wasn't going to LA at all. It would be going to the farms and orchards in the San Fernando Valley, which belonged in large part to a syndicate of the most powerful men in the city.
Oh, so they're just taking the water for other farms?
Pretty much, yeah. They're just making the rich men richer with this entire community's, like, resources and water.
Yeah. Well, don't sell them the rights.
Yeah, that I mean, know? Again, it wasn't like acquired illegally, but it was acquired in a very shady way. So they were mad.
It doesn't even sound like it was shady. Like, they just bought it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know exactly how the transactions went, but it seemed like Eaton came in there and put up a show about him being like a rancher moving to the area or something. And like, that was very much not the case. He was
kind of posing as a rancher.
Yeah, he was lying to them.
That's shady behavior.
Exactly. It turned out that the owner of the Los Angeles Times and some other associates had bought a lot of land there, like where the water was being shipped in the San Fernando Valley, and those wealthy landowners were making a killing from this water. But like I mentioned earlier, they were in a drought, and this threat of shortages accelerated the next phase in Mulholland's master plan. In a dry year, if there wasn't a lot of snow in the Sierra Nevada mountains, the aqueduct wouldn't deliver as much water to Los Angeles. So at this point, he needed to come up with a solution for storage. A big reservoir to fill up in the wet years to hold you over in the dry years. So in the summer of 1922, Mulholland decided to build new dams near the southern end of the aqueduct. The Hollywood Dam, in the hills overlooking LA, and biggest of all, the St. Francis Dam in a canyon 40 miles northwest of the city. Plans were drawn up in Mulholland's office in the fall of 1922. 20 years before, the city had required that a group of experts review his plans for the aqueduct, but that wasn't the case anymore. He had earned his right to sort of do what he wanted. So he drew up the plans and they were like, perfect, there's a dam.
Oh, they didn't check it?
No. This would be the second largest storage reservoir in Southern California. It should have been peer-reviewed. At least some people outside of his organization should have been reviewing it and just looking at it, but by 1922, nobody was questioning him. So he drew up these plans, and nobody's checking it over.
Wow. I mean, that's bold.
Yeah.
I don't know. He must have done something right on the aqueduct.
He did. I mean, the aqueduct was a huge thing, and he did it well. So there is that, but it doesn't mean that he isn't going to make a mistake at some point.
Yeah. I mean, that's nuts because anything I ever do at my job is peer reviewed and I'm changing like very minor things that do not harm anyone.
Yeah.
If I mess up.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. I mean, things should just be checked over if they're important, especially if it's something that could actually physically harm a person. You know, like if it fails, people could die. So that's something that definitely should be checked over, but it was
maybe
not.
That's the bar.
Yeah, right? Like, the bar is pretty low at this point. But in April of 1924, the construction workers arrived in the San Francisquito Canyon in Santa Clarita, about 47 miles north of downtown Los Angeles. It had been 12 years since Mulholland's crew ran the southern end of the aqueduct through there, and 3 years since they finished building a generating station called Powerhouse 2, about a mile downstream from the dam. The Powerhouse 2 workers and their families lived in wooden bungalows clustered around the plant at the bottom of the canyon. And at that time, their small community was overrun with men and machinery. But just as the project was gearing up, it took on a new urgency. Because the people in Owens Valley were so pissed, they decided to blow up a portion of the aqueduct with dynamite.
Whoa.
Yeah. On May 21st, 1924, a massive explosion occurred, destroying a portion of the aqueduct in Owens Valley. So they're like, listen, I'm going to just blow it up. Like, you took my water, I'm going to take it back with dynamite.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the thing about just taking stuff from people, is that they always get a vote if they get pissed off enough, you know?
Right. What's so ironic about this situation is that the settlers of Owens Valley had simply taken the land from the Native Americans. So it's like,
well,
this is karma.
Wait, did they,
unfortunately,
did they like do some similar land contract that they didn't explain to the natives? And
yeah, from what I remember, yes, I don't have it written down in my notes, but yeah, it was something like that.
Well, you know,
yeah, not the greatest. They're like, hey, we don't like it when it happens to us. Like, yeah, obviously it's shitty.
Yeah.
But that being said, I do understand the frustration. I mean, they were literally depleting all of their resources and they were losing their economy and their everything.
Yeah.
Like, they were in a major drought. So.
Yeah, well, if you can't grow food, like, if you put somebody in a corner like that, I mean, they're going to blow up your aqueduct.
They're going to blow up your aqueduct. So the damage was repaired within only a few days. But as far as the activists in the valley were concerned, the fight was just getting started. The aqueduct was a disaster for Owens Valley. The people who lived there lost almost all of their water, and it had become a desolate place. It was a complete undoing of their lives and their home. But to LA and Mulholland, this explosion was terrorism. They were destroying the water supply for this major urban center. And 6 months after the first attack, over 100 men seized the aqueduct control gates in Owens Valley and opened up the valves and released the water onto their parched land. And they said they wouldn't restore the flow until the city agreed to pay reparations and limit any further expansion of the project. By noon the next day, hundreds of men and women and children had joined in on this siege in Owens River Valley. And after a while, it had kind of come to look like more of a huge barbecue, like people were just gathering and hanging out. And families came with picnics, and businesses in the valley closed for the occasion, and a group of musicians arrived. It lasted 4 days, which was long enough to make news around the world. And to Mulholland's annoyance, much of the coverage painted their actions as a noble struggle against the corporation and power of Los Angeles. It became known in the press as the quote-unquote Little Civil War. And that went on for a few years. Like, they went back and forth, blowing up the aqueduct and then repairing it and then blowing it up. Like, it was not great.
Wow.
By the fall of 1924, St. Francis Dam was in the full swing of construction, and the canyon was a hive of activity full of workers and trucks carrying sand and gravel to a small concrete plant at the downstream face of the dam. And they would continue that construction for the next 16 months. The St. Francis Dam was a gravity dam, which has a retaining wall that you're building to have something of much greater weight and stability than the forces you're putting against it. A dam that is a triangular shape should be able to hold back a lake that's of infinite length. So if constructed correctly, it should have been able to hold a lot of water.
Infinite length?
That's what the documentary I watched said.
Damn.
I know.
Okay. I didn't mean that one. Okay.
I know it's like something you just say, but it does make me giggle in this context.
Why the triangle?
That's just how you construct it. Like, the base has to be really thick in order for it to not like fail.
Okay. I just always imagine them as like the, I'm thinking of like a bowl.
Yeah.
Type deal.
Yeah, kind of. It does kind of look like that on the outside, but you're thinking of like the face of the dam, but like the actual, like if you looked at the dam from its side, it would be skinnier at the top and then really thick at the bottom.
Right. Okay.
I hope the people listening can understand without my hand motions. As work continued on the dam, Mulholland decided to make it taller than he originally planned. He had made a promise that he would create a dam that would be able to contain 1 year's worth of water for Los Angeles, because the population was increasing so much every year, they needed a lot more water. So Mulholland made the dam taller by 10 feet the first year they were in construction, and then by the second year, he increased it again. But both times he did that, he didn't increase the base width, which, like I just said, is incredibly important. So he's just kind of changing dimensions on the fly, like during construction, and nobody is checking his work. It ended up at a height of 195 feet with the ability to hold 12.4 billion gallons of water in the reservoir, which was 25% bigger than initially anticipated. And making it taller wasn't the issue, but to account for the extra pressure that would be put on the dam, he needed to make the base thicker as well to make it sturdy enough. But Mulholland didn't realize that, and so he was still very confident in his project. At the same time, Mulholland was distracted by an even more ambitious project, the Boulder Dam Project, or the Hoover Dam, which was an undertaking that dwarfed even the aqueduct. They'd be taking water from the Colorado River and moving it to various places in Southern California. And Mulholland was a consultant on that project, and it was feeding into his idea of what he believed Southern California could become. So he's preoccupied. He's drawn up the plans for the dam, and now he's on to bigger and better things.
More dams.
Yes, more dams. So while this massive dam was being built in the San Francisco Canyon, Mulholland would be gone for weeks at a time. At the same time, behind the St. Francis Dam, the water was rising and the pressure was building. When it was completed in the spring of 1926, there was almost no notice of it. There had been a number of dynamite attacks along the aqueduct, so they didn't want to draw attention to the dam.
Yeah, don't blow up the dam.
Right. So even though this massive structure, this massive concrete wall and structure is being built in this canyon, a lot of people, even like at the base of it, since they couldn't actually physically see it being built, like they didn't know it was there.
They didn't know it was there. Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild.
And I know.
It's going to hold back billions of gallons of water?
Yeah, 12 billion.
I don't even know what that means.
Right. I don't either. By 1927, there had been an explosion that ripped out one of the largest siphons in the aqueduct, and a few nights later, another 60-foot section was destroyed. So, right after this dam is built, they're still blowing up parts of the aqueduct, so they're and just trying to keep it under wraps a little bit.
Yeah, and it's been almost a year and a half since they started doing that?
I think two years.
2 years?
Yeah.
Wow. So it's literally a war,
kind of? Yes, yeah, the Little Civil War.
This is insane. This stuff just kind of happened.
Yeah, I know.
Back then. Could you imagine this happening today?
No. And that's what's so crazy is that nobody really knows about this. Like, I feel like most people don't know this story.
No, I didn't. But I mean, to just imagine a similar situation happening today, like for any reason, people are blowing up water feeding into Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know,
it's really like the definition of the Wild West a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, the feds would descend on them faster than flies on shit.
Yeah. And I actually don't even think anyone was arrested. Like, I don't think they ever really knew exactly who was to blame for the explosions.
Were they looking into it?
Like, I hope so. You know?
I mean, also, it's 200 some miles of aqueduct.
Over
you have
200.
To guard all the time. It's just not possible.
Right. Yeah, that's unrealistic. So, yeah, they were just getting away with blowing up this aqueduct because they were mad.
Kind of fair.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I get it. I do get it.
A little bit fair.
Yeah.
That's what's also crazier. Kind of like, okay, you know, like. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when the newspapers got wind of this, they were, like, painting it as a noble thing that the Owens River Valley was doing. So, anyway. Yeah, hundreds of armed guards were sent in to, like, try and guard this aqueduct, but nobody was ever arrested, as far as I know. And despite the concerns about a potential attack on the dam, the communities that were in the flood path were never told about the dam or any possible danger they were in. The Santa Clara River Valley stretched 50 miles from the San Francisco Canyon to the Pacific Ocean. This area was highly desirable to live in because there were lots of citrus farms and oil wells, which was great for newcomers in search of work. Around that time, Mulholland had gotten a call from his dam keeper, a man named Tony Harnischweger. He and his family lived in the shadow of this enormous dam, and Harnischweger was highly attuned to the dam's condition. Over the last year, Tony had watched as a series of cracks had appeared in the dam. There were at least 4 major cracks, and they went all the way through the dam. Mulholland had plugged all of these cracks with oakum on the downstream face of the dam, which wasn't great. And I looked up oakum because I didn't know what it was. And it says that it's a hemp or jute fiber soaked with tar or something like tar and used in caulking seams of like wooden ships or packing joints like pipes. But I don't think it was a very good solution.
Yeah, I mean, if the concrete was going to crack, I don't think that something functioning as a caulking is gonna
hold up
forever.
Yeah.
You know?
It seemed like a quick fix kind of thing. But also they had just constructed this massive dam. So like,
how long after did it crack?
A year.
I mean,
yeah.
You know,
right.
What's going on? And all the way, you said it cracked all the way through.
Yeah. So apparently it's not uncommon for dams to develop cracks, but like,
huh?
I was shocked when I heard that too, and I could be wrong. Someone said that and I'm repeating it back to you. They said like a few cracks are not too crazy, but like, you know, the amount that the St. Francis Dam had was bad.
That's insane to me.
I know.
So dams just be cracking like all the time and people are like, it's fine. Until you get to 4, then it's a problem. What a fragile world we have.
Yeah, I just Googled it and it says all concrete dams have cracks.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe not that crazy then, but I don't know. A year seems short.
Yeah. And I think it was like the severity of the cracks. Like I think little ones are one thing, but these were like massive cracks that were going all the way through. And so Tony was like, hey, I'm
check it out.
Seeing something that's concerning here.
He's the dam keeper.
Right. And Mulholland plugging the cracks with oakum was one of the worst things he could have done, because now he was taking that hydraulic pressure and putting it on the interior of the dam. The reservoir had been filled to capacity for the first time 5 days before Tony made another call to Mulholland, and water was now leaking under the dam's west side. So Tony had alerted Mulholland and his deputy, Harvey Van Norman, on the morning of March 12th that the west abutment of the dam was leaking muddy water, which was a sign that the foundation of the dam was failing. Mulholland and Van Norman went out right away to take a look at the dam, but what he told Tony was there's no active erosion occurring from the dam foundation, so quote-unquote, this is a lot about nothing. He told Tony that the water was running clear and everything was safe, and he made it back to his office for a late lunch. But Tony was on edge, and reports would later say that on March 10th, an acquaintance of his said Tony had been reprimanded for talking in the manner he had, meaning bringing up these concerns, and if he continued to do so, he might lose his job. So the dam keeper isn't allowed to bring up issues with the dam, or he might lose his job.
Yeah, I mean, it's just hard for me to hear the dam is leaking, and then he just looks at it and goes, it's fine.
No, it's cool.
Goes for a late lunch.
Right? Yeah, not great. And with every passing minute, the internal stresses in the dam continued multiplying. At around 11:20 p.m., the structure finally began to give way. A huge crack opened up on its upstream side. This was when those few extra feet of height made a big difference. It was like straws on a camel's back. The dam didn't have the capacity to stop the loads that were being put on it, and at that time, the central section of the dam was actually tilting forward. Then another defect in Mulholland's design came into play. Water was seeping under the base of the dam and had begun pushing up at the bottom, which is called uplift. The dam had basically pushed up off of its foundation. And like most modern dams, the St. Francis Dam included relief wells to prevent this uplift, but it only had that in its center section. So like the east and the west side of the dam didn't have this prevention. And the wings of the dam were beginning to slip away. So by 11:30 p.m., a massive chunk of the dam that had been severed by cracks and weakened by uplift just blew out. And intensely pressurized water began jetting through this gap, because 12.4 billion gallons of water is on the other side.
How much pressure? So many.
So many pressure.
Yeah, I mean, what do you even do at this point?
Pray.
Pray? Warn people?
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do?
Do you know how far the water was shooting?
In that moment? No. Far. I mean, it was highly pressurized.
Yeah.
The entire east wing of the dam was on the verge of collapse. Over time, the water from the reservoir had begun to saturate the east abutment, which was made up of schist, which is basically layers of slate that were stacked on each other. And because this hillside was at an angle, the water was getting in between these slate-like layers, and they literally slid out like a deck of cards once the water got like into them. So the entire like east and west side of the dam just like collapsed like a deck of cards. And the only thing that was left standing was the center column of the dam by the end of this. Isn't that kind of interesting though? Like the center part of it didn't collapse.
Really?
Yeah, just the east and west sides, yeah.
It never falls down?
No.
I guess after that point, there's not as much pressure.
Right, yeah.
Jesus.
At 2.5 minutes before midnight, the entire hillside under the east wing collapsed into the dam. As an immense amount of water shot out, the west side crumbled down. Tony Harnischweger probably saw it happen. The landslide severed the wires carrying power to Los Angeles, causing the lights in the city to flicker. At the same time, the ground vibrated as 1 million cubic feet of water per second rushed down the canyon. The sound of the collapsing dam took a little less than 7 seconds to reach the cluster of cabins around the powerhouse number 2, where it woke Lillian Curtis. She looked out to see a quote-unquote misty haze hanging over everything. It almost sounded like a thunderstorm, but soon she grabbed her husband and screamed, "The dam has broke," because they're just like in a little community just underneath the dam, so they're like the first ones to get hit. It was a colossal force coming down the canyon, almost impossible to comprehend. It was a 140-foot wall of water. Curtis scrambled to the side of the canyon, like up a hill, with her 3-year-old son, as her husband went back to get their daughters. But that would be the last time she would see him or her daughters. 126 of the 129 people who lived near Powerhouse 2 died in the flood. Only 3 people.
How?
They climbed up the side of the canyon, like before the water hit, so they were able to get to higher ground. They only had, like, barely a few minutes.
Wow. And only 3 of them got high enough?
Mm-hmm. And one of them was a child, like a baby.
Wow.
The flood hit the town of Castaic at around 1 a.m., with waves between 55 and 75 feet high, and nearly washed the whole thing away. After the water passed through, the town was swept as bare as a pool table, is what one newspaper said later on. At the time, that town was a popular travel route, with a well-known cafe, gas station, and cabins where people would stay. A father and son who were in the area that night saw, in the distance, lights flashing and some rumbling, and they wondered if a storm was coming. But then, as if out of a scary movie, they see the cabins lift up off of their foundation and start moving toward them. The water had just picked up the cabins and were moving toward them. And they were able to grab onto a utility pole and hold on for dear life. But at that point, the flood had barbed wire and structures and railroad tracks, dead animals, and waves 60 feet high. So the father lost grip on the pole and was ripped away to his death, as so many other people were. Piru was another one of the first towns to be hit by the flood, and it did have a hill for protection, but the people closest to the river didn't have time to escape the water. The flood hit the train track so hard that it ripped the entire thing up and twisted it, and in other places, the rails were lifted up and dropped onto entirely different roadways. I mean, think about railroad tracks. Like, that can't be an easy thing to lift up, and this water just, like, tossed it like it was nothing.
Yeah, I agree. Although, when I think of railroad tracks, I'm thinking it's on top of rocks.
I guess. You know what I mean? I just would assume it's incredibly heavy.
I don't know. I always thought that the train kind of pushed it down.
All right. I don't know. We can't debate this right now. Like, I'm just thinking about a crazy wall of water.
Took it and like twisted it.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's 140 foot or even 60 foot waves.
Yeah. As it like got further down the valley, it like became smaller, but like smaller is not even a good way to represent it because it was humongous compared to a person and like a house.
Yeah, I know. And it just like gaining speed all the way downhill.
Mm-hmm. By 3 a.m., the wave burst into one of the largest towns in the flood path, Santa Paula, where hundreds of workers slept in their bare bones houses on citrus orchards. These were majority undocumented Mexican workers who picked the citrus. They were given houses with no electricity or indoor plumbing on these citrus farms, so they would have no idea that the water was coming toward them. They couldn't even receive a call, which was really bad because they were in the direct line of the flood path. One worker recalled the confusion as indescribable. Most of the people who were killed probably never knew what was happening to them. They just knew they were drowning or were getting struck with massive debris. And this lack of electricity was really terrible for this town because telephones did play an important role when the flood hit. Some of the heroes of the disaster were the Hello Girls, or phone operators in the towns along the flood path who stayed at their switchboards and furiously called as many people as they could to warn them of the water headed their way. And in most cases, this warning only gave people a few minutes to spare, but those minutes were the difference between life and death. If it hadn't been for those Hello Girls, hundreds more people would have died. And when you look at who did and who didn't survive, it does sadly reveal a place in time that was very divided by race. The story of Thelma McCauley illustrates that well. She was a 13-year-old girl suffering from measles at the time, but when she felt her house lift upwards in the water, she scrambled to get her mother, father, and 17-year-old brother out of the house before she escaped out the back door. After she was carried for 9 miles by this water, she got stuck up in the branches of a tree, and she passed out at some point and woke up later in the Santa Paula Red Cross station for survivors. And when a woman came over and started bathing all the debris and the mud off of her, she exclaimed, "Oh, you're a white girl," and she was immediately transferred across the street into, I guess, her own home for further care, or like a better place. So even in the aftermath of the tragedy, the makeshift hospitals and morgues were segregated. Luckily, La Cruz Azul Mexicana stepped in, which was run primarily by Mexican women and the Mexican consulate, and they translated for Spanish-speaking flood victims. But even with these translators, officials, for the most part, didn't even interview Mexican survivors, deeming them unfit to give their account, so many of their stories are still unknown.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's crazy to hear about how, like, instant it was. It was as soon as they realize she's white, she just gets transferred.
Yeah, suddenly she has more value, or, like, they should take care of her better. It's crazy.
Yeah, and then, like, unfit to just describe what happened to you is kind of crazy.
I know. You know. Yeah, and it was these communities who were hit the worst because, you know, like I said, for the lemon orchard or the lemon farm, they didn't have that warning call. So,
right.
Yeah, it was really like you had a better chance if you had more money. In Santa Paula, 10-year-old Soledad Luna heard shouting outside before the water hit. Two policemen on motorcycles were going around screaming, "Agua, agua." Soledad's father thought they were crazy because there hadn't been any rain, so what water were they talking about? At that point, they hadn't really been paying much attention until their neighbors started running. Minutes had passed as Soledad's father and her uncle had packed the family's possessions before finally grabbing her cousins. Her uncle gathered her cousins and put the four oldest in the flatbed of the truck, and his wife in the cab of the truck holding their infant when the water hit. And the truck immediately toppled over and was swept away. With nowhere to go, Soledad's mother grabbed her four children and huddled them together on the bed in their home. The first impact tore their house apart, and they were sent into the flood. But miraculously, Soledad, her mother, and her three siblings were carried away on the crest of the flood on their bed as a life raft. Their mattress was their raft.
They were riding the wave?
Yes. Yeah, but Soledad's luck ran out when her hair became tangled in the branches of a tree, and she was pulled from the bed and from her mother and siblings. And she had to watch as they floated away into the darkness. Her mother tried to grab her, but she couldn't. It was dark, and they were whisked away so quickly. Soledad couldn't see much, but she could hear a lot of really terrible things around her, like animals drowning and people screaming. As the flood carried her family down the stream, it spread across the landscape until the leading edge was almost 2 miles wide.
Holy shit. That's such a massive scale.
I know. But even with the water being that spread out, it still had enough power to demolish railroad and highway bridges. Along the way, it had picked up the majority of the Santa Clara River Valley. Orchard trees, cattle, homes, vehicles, everything. And as it got closer to the ocean, it became mixed with oil from the oil drilling. It had become this terrible mix of sludge and rocks and parts of steel bridges, animals, and bodies. At 5:25 in the morning, the floodwater finally made it to the ocean. Over 5.5 hours, the water had traveled 54 miles and was miles long. The next day was gloomy and overcast as the survivors of the flood saw the aftermath. It was as if there was no color at all that morning. There were homes broken into pieces, uprooted trees, and bodies everywhere. Boy Scouts went out with little flags, and when they found a body, they would put a flag in the ground, and then a recovery crew would come and put the body on a stretcher and load them onto trucks and take them into town. Rescuers found Lillian Curtis, her son, and a neighbor on the hillside overlooking the ruins of Powerhouse 2. Everyone else in that town was dead. Soledad's mother and her three small children were found in the ocean, on the mattress that had carried them away from Soledad.
Dude. They rode it 54 miles into the ocean?
They were about halfway into the flood path, so like about 25.
They had a whole marathon to the ocean on...
No, I know.
...a mattress.
Yeah, they rode a mattress down a flood into the ocean. Soledad was found many hours later, still hanging from the tree that she had gotten caught on in the flood. She was thankfully alive as well.
She was hanging from the tree by her hair, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And survived. Did she, like, she got yanked by the tree.
Off the mattress, yeah.
Off the mattress by her hair.
Mm-hmm.
And then she just hung by her hair?
Yeah, unfortunately.
For hours until she got discovered?
Yep, and then she was rescued.
That's insane.
I know. Until the day she died, she could remember the man who found her and got her down from the tree. His name was Mr. Baxter.
And they married?
Nope.
No?
No, she was like 10.
Oh, and
he was an old man.
Word.
Right. But yeah, it's still like it was, it obviously left a huge impact on her. How could it not? So anyway.
Yeah, I mean, so sudden.
Yeah, I mean, horrifying. Soledad's mother wasn't the only one who survived on a floating mattress. 74-year-old Old Man Kofer, is what his name was written down as, was asleep when his mattress was swept up. And the next thing he remembered was clinging to the mattress on his knees after his wife was swept into the flood, which is so terrible to think about. And he eventually landed in a lemon orchard where he was found and was rescued. So he also was on a mattress. But those were just some of the survivors. Mulholland didn't arrive to the scene until late the next morning. He stood in shock and awe and horror looking at the aftermath of the flood where the St. Francis Dam once was. Reports say he was looking old and shaky, probably because that was the moment he realized this wouldn't be a rescue situation, it would be a body recovery mission. All that was left was the center column of the dam that hadn't collapsed, but everything else from the dam was gone. And something really crazy is within days, tourists began showing up at the disaster zone. They collected bits of debris as souvenirs, and they climbed the last standing piece of the dam that they would now call the tombstone, and they took photos in front of it as if it were this like place to come and sightsee. It became like a morbid attraction.
Whoa.
Which is like terrible for a lot of reasons, but also it started like days after the flood. So they were still cleaning up bodies and people were coming to like take pictures of it.
Yeah, I mean, a different time. But I mean, like, you got to kind of think about what this time was, right? All of this racial segregation, and it's like World War I had just ended. I just feel that people probably were much more desensitized to the loss of life.
Yeah,
and
maybe
these types of events than we would feel towards it.
That's true. Also, there's very much the whole morbid curiosity thing, and they didn't have like as much media coverage, you know, like they had newspapers.
Yeah. Also, they were taking pictures in front of it.
Yeah, they were taking like tourist photos,
like you light it on fire and it goes poof type of picture.
I
like what
like
kind
the
of old-timey camera?
Timey cameras?
Yeah, like what kind of camera are they using?
I, you know, that's a good question. Maybe they had like a whole ass rig to take a picture of themselves in front of this collapsed dam. I have no idea. But
you know
yeah,
what I mean? It just like takes, it took a lot more effort to take a picture back then.
It did. Well, there was this 18-year-old boy who climbed the dam, and tragically, he fell off of the dam and died because he climbed all the way like up and then fell off. And because of that, they were like, okay, now we have to destroy it, because if people keep coming here and the dam keeps claiming people's lives, like, this is terrible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was bad for a lot of reasons. And that spurred some really valid anger and bitterness among the survivors of the flood that this morbid attraction had, like, become a thing. Because communities were wiped out and washed away, and people were just picking up debris as souvenirs.
Yeah, I mean, you could imagine you lose your entire family.
Yeah, the whole thing.
And you're watching people just use it as a tourist attraction.
Yeah, make it a spectacle. Mulholland started getting death threats to his house, and along the flood path, there was a town with a sign that said, "Hang Mulholland." Searchers were still finding bodies everywhere, in very different conditions. Most people weren't even drowned. They were killed by the massive force of the water and debris inside it. So many people joined the search efforts. They would look for vultures in the sky to indicate where the bodies were, because they were just so scattered everywhere. Some bodies were found as far as San Diego and even the Mexican border.
From it started, did it go through LA or?
So it kind of went in a path like above LA and like out to the ocean. But I mean, the flood made it to the ocean. So bodies were put into the water, and I guess they just were carried all the way down to San Diego and the Mexican border.
Wow.
Yeah. Along the flood path, pyres of animal carcasses and debris were set aflame to try to clear the area, but it's possible some bodies ended up getting burned, making it even harder to confirm the actual number of dead. And there were some bodies that were never found. It's actually unclear how many people actually died that night, because there were so many transient people in these communities and migrant workers who lived along the river who would never be known. There are estimates running from 400 to 600 people that died, but we'll never actually know. For the supporters of the Hoover Dam, the disaster couldn't have come at a worse time. The Senate was just about to decide the fate of the project just as the catastrophe hit. The Hoover Dam was the largest line item expenditure in the history of the U.S., and they had the votes to get it done, but Mulholland was the biggest and loudest supporter of the Hoover Dam, and then the St. Francis Dam collapsed. On March 15th, 2 days after the disaster, California Governor Cece Young began an investigation into the dam's failure. The city at some point tried to suggest that the dam broke because of the vengeful Owens Valley bombers who blew up the dam, but that was quickly debunked, and within a week, the investigators announced that the dam collapsed due to a deficiency in the soil under the West Wing, which was reassuring because the failure was unlikely to be repeated. And they kind of didn't want to investigate too much into it. But in reality, the cause was oversight and hubris. Because, you know, Mulholland was like, I can do whatever I want.
It's just bad design.
Yeah, definitely bad design. And also, geological engineer J. Davis Rogers believes that a landslide triggered the dam's failure, tearing up the foundation of the dam and making it lean, which made it open up all of the existing cracks. So it was a kind of a combination of, like, the land and also the fact that it was just poorly constructed.
Okay. All right, so are dams built to withstand a landslide?
That is a question for a civil engineer.
I'll call him up.
Yeah, call up your friend. And the city moved quickly to settle with the survivors. They had agreed upon a fixed price of $5,000 for a human life, which is not enough, but that's what was decided, and they paid the survivors very quickly.
I mean, $5,000 in 1920 probably ain't that bad.
I mean, for what they were paying them for, it was, you know, you could never really put a price tag on that kind of thing. But they just wanted the whole thing out of the way. At the end of everything, the city of Los Angeles ended up paying $14 million in hope that the public would just forget the disaster.
They're not going to forget.
Well, not in the, you know, recent future of that time, but in the future, like currently, people don't really know about it or remember it.
True.
So.
But I bet they remembered that for a few decades.
Yeah, I would assume so. But for Mulholland, issues were just beginning because some of the victims had died in Los Angeles County, which meant the LA coroner had to decide if a crime had been committed. They had to determine if someone was responsible and if they were going to indict anyone. And William Mulholland very possibly could have been indicted for murder. 8 days after the disaster, William Mulholland took the stand at the LA County Courthouse. At that time, 277 bodies had been found, but hundreds were still missing. Mulholland at times was evasive and cold under interrogation, but he did eventually say, quote, "If there is any error in human judgment, I was the human. I won't try to fasten it onto anybody else." So he did take responsibility, which made it so people had someone to blame and also an issue they could remove. The general consensus is if Mulholland had known more about concrete dams and had taken the time to learn more about the geology of the San Francisquito Canyon, he may have built a better dam. In November of 1928, a few weeks before the Senate vote on the Hoover Dam, William Mulholland retired from the Water Bureau. He was given a pension. They held a banquet for him, and no mention was ever made of the St. Francis Dam.
Well.
Yeah. So in the spring of 1929, the city of Los Angeles destroyed the remaining pieces of the dam. They blew it up, but that didn't make the memory of the dam and William Mulholland disappear. There was also the Hollywood Dam, if we remember, and now nobody trusted it. They ended up bringing the water down in like the reservoir by two-thirds. So now it holds only one-third of the water it's able to hold.
Wait, so is it still at a third of its capacity today just because people don't trust it?
I think so, yeah. For safety reasons. I mean, it's right in the Hollywood Hills, so that would be bad.
Oh, it'd be real bad. I'm just saying it's like a third of what it could hold. That's what you
yes.
said.
So yeah.
Could do more.
I understand the distrust.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Mulholland's health began to deteriorate after he had a stroke, and he died in L.A. on July 22nd, 1935. As time went on, the memory of the St. Francis Dam began to fade from the general public, but it left the deep impression among engineers who would be designing the next generation of public works. Especially with the Hoover Dam, its creators were determined to leave the ghosts of the St. Francis Dam in the past. While St. Francis Dam was built from one man's design and then changed on the fly during construction, the Hoover Dam was scrutinized by teams of experts at every stage of its design and construction. So it's safe to say I think the Hoover Dam is going to be okay. I mean, shit, I hope.
We knock on wood.
I don't know.
They certainly planned a lot better.
They definitely had a lot more review along the way. So that's good. Throughout the story, Mulholland is the villain, and that's who we point to. But there were a lot of other people who overwhelmingly supported it. Like, yes, he was the guy who drew up the plans and was kind of in charge, but there were a lot of people that were involved that also could be pointed to a little bit. And it wasn't just that they made a bad dam. It largely had to do with greed. They felt like they could have it all. Even though there isn't a ton of rain and the sun is always shining and the population is growing, they felt like they could feed the entire city of LA and just do whatever they wanted and take as much as they wanted. These dams have led to an unsustainable future. People are very optimistic that technology will solve these environmental problems, that sometimes we lose sight of other ways to solve these problems. And in the documentary, they said, quote, "We're going to have to learn to manage our resources, most particularly water. So this story is a warning." Like, let's maybe be a little bit smarter with our resources. So anyway,
yeah.
At the end, I hate that it turned to like global warming and shit, but like,
It doesn't sound like global warming. It just sounds like an environmental thing.
Yeah, like an environmental issue. So yeah. Anyway, they're like, let's not be greedy with our resources, shall we?
Yeah, but in fairness, it kind of has worked out thus far.
Okay. I don't know that it has or hasn't, right? So I'm not going to comment. But it did lead to better regulations like the California Dam Safety Act and the Civil Engineers Registration Act in 1929. So there was that. But that is the story of the St. Francis Dam collapse. And wow, that's a massive disaster.
Yeah. I mean, the scale of it was insane. You said that at one point it was 54 miles wide.
No, it traveled 54 miles.
Oh.
It was about 2 miles wide at one point, and I believe it expanded further than that as far as like the wave goes. But no, yeah, it traveled 54 miles. That would have been crazy. If it was 54 miles wide.
Well, I mean, that's why I was like, that's a little wild.
Yeah. It was essentially a man-made tsunami.
Yeah. But to think if you're in the middle of that, you have to like run a mile to get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Or you got to hit higher ground.
Right.
And you have minutes to do it.
Right. Yeah. And that's like how some people did survive, because they were able to get to like higher ground or to a place that wasn't in the wave path. But like, that took people recognizing what was going on, and most people didn't, which is why those like hello girls were so important, because the people that did get those few extra minutes lived. So it's interesting. It's very dark history, but it is interesting.
Yeah, give you that.
And it's also crazy that like on top of all of this, the like aqueduct explosions, like dynamite, was just kind of like a side note. Like, that wasn't, like, a main stage to this actual disaster. It was just like also, people were blowing up the aqueduct.
Yeah, well, what happened to that?
Nothing. They just blew up pieces of it, and then I think eventually stopped.
But they were still taking water?
Oh, you mean, that like, Mulholland and stuff in L.A.? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the aqueducts didn't go away.
No, yeah, it stayed.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It just feels like such a big piece of like history that it's just crazy to me that most people don't know about it. I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the story. I don't really think I have much more to say on that. But would you like to have a palate cleanser and tell me your good thing?
Yeah. My good thing is that we are celebrating a friend's birthday.
Oh, yeah.
They know who they are.
You special guy.
Special boy, you know, and it's going to be fun.
Yeah, we're having an adult slumber party.
Yeah, and I asked this question because it's a slumber party at somebody's parents' house.
It's so fun. Yeah, our friend is like, oh yeah, my parents are going to be out of town, so we can sleep at their house. So we're just going to be like a bunch of teenagers, which is very funny.
And I was asking, I was send, what age is too old to do that?
It's never, you're never too old. I don't want to, well, you're never too old. I don't want to like sleep over people's houses regularly because I enjoy being in my own space in my own bed, but like, I'm always going to be down for like a silly time.
No, I'm just like, could you imagine you're like about to retire or you are retired and you're going to go hang out with your friends and spend the night at your parents' house?
Well, the parents' house thing is the kicker. It's not really the slumber party. It's the fact that
the slumber party is like, okay, you drank too much, you got to sleep here, whatever. But
Yeah. It is funny.
Right?
Yeah.
I put the number at, I think, 30.
Okay.
I think once you have a 3 in front of your age, it's...
You shouldn't be hosting at your parents' house.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair. That's very fair. But yeah, I'm excited for that as well.
All right. Well, anyway, what's your good thing?
My good thing is that I've been seeing some plays, and I'm excited that I am like seeing live theater again. It's been a while since I've seen live theater, and I'm seeing a bunch of it, and I love it.
And we love that for you.
Thank you.
We do. And I will be there.
Yeah, we're going to go see a play tomorrow night. So yeah, very good. That's my good thing. Short and sweet. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to hear a bunch of bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you would like to get your merch while it's hot, head over to nottodaypodcast.myshopify.com. If you or anyone you know has a story that you'd like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listener's episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. Head over to Instagram to see all the photos of all the stories we talk about, nottoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is not today podcast and a Twitter that is not today podcast with a T on the end of podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.